I didn't grow up with this. When I was a kid, going to church every Sunday as I did, I seldom saw anyone do this, save the pastor. The pastor would often, in the service, usually at the beginning, sometime there in the middle, and at the end of the service, make the sign of the cross. Very rarely, when I, with my young eyes, surveyed the congregation at those moments, did I see someone also make the sign of the cross at the same time over themselves. I usually assumed that that was one of those Roman Catholics who was visiting church that Sunday. I don't know if it was or it wasn't, but I did note lately that as I travel around preaching at various churches, I see more and more people making the sign of the cross. It seems to be enjoying something of a comeback. What does it mean? Why do Christians do this? Is this merely a Roman Catholic practice? We're going to talk about the sign of the cross during the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. We are coming to you live this Thursday, the 13th of November. Yesterday, unfortunately, I had a little bit of a plumbing problem at the house that took the better part of the day to resolve, but it is resolved. The water is flowing again in both directions, and all is well. So I'm able to come back, no worse for wear. And no, I do not. Gary is holding his nose. I have showered since I plunged headfirst into the mess that was my basement yesterday. Pastor David Peterson joins us here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about the sign of the cross. In the second half hour, we'll be talking with two guests, one from the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Their Director of Government Affairs, Connie Mackey, will join us to talk about, well, they're calling it a talkathon. What is going on in the Senate right now? It started yesterday, continues until midnight tonight. It has something to do with George W. Bush's judicial nominees and the inability of the Senate to vote on them. We'll talk about that. And in the midst of that second half hour, Senator Jim Talent of Missouri joins us to explain it to us himself and to get some of his reactions as the senators pull an all-nighter and an all-dayer up there on Capitol Hill. In the third hour, in the second hour of Issues Etc., look how much is already there in the first hour of the program for you. In the second hour of the program, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer joins us, author of the book Testing the Claims of Church Growth. We're going to talk about where the church growth movement is going. He's been examining some of the writings of the brightest lights of church growth, and he'll bring some of those insights to us in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, Judge Roy Moore. He has been removed. Not only has his monument been removed from the judicial building, now officially he has been removed from the judiciary, the Supreme Court of Alabama. This ethical committee heard testimony yesterday, ruled today. He is all over the news with reaction. We'll hear from him and others and get your reaction as well in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to join the conversation anytime during these 3 hours or here in the first hour as we talk about the sign of the cross. Pastor David Peterson is our guest, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of an article in the latest issue of For the Life of the World magazine. No, that's not For the Life of the World. That's Higher Things. Higher Things magazine titled The Sign of the Cross. Pastor Peterson, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's clear up this one, the one that I lived with for quite some time. Whenever I saw someone as a child making the sign of the cross in church or elsewhere, I automatically assumed that they were Roman Catholic because that's just a Roman Catholic thing.
Yeah.
How do you respond?
Well, I think, first of all, that's a legitimate interpretation in terms of historically in America. I mean, I think it's sort of sad, but mostly the Lutherans in America didn't do this. Until recently, though it's true that in the Lutheran hymnal published in 1941, those of your Lutheran listeners, page 4, before page 5, which is the beginning order of worship, there's a list of rubrics, instructions, explanations about, you know, what's going to come in the service. And it actually says in there, 1941, that the sign of the cross may be made at the invocation and at the Nicene Creed. So it's always been with us. We just never did it. It's in Luther's catechism. It's in our hymnals. It's just that we were a little bit afraid of being identified here in America with the Roman Catholics. We have to remember that historically there was a great deal of prejudice in America against people of color, against Jewish people and against Roman Catholics. And because of that, often, you know, people would do things to distance themselves from those things. So we wanted to look like the frontier American pioneer worship, you know, with tent meetings and so forth, and that's why it got dropped. So I think, anyway, what I would say, if you said, well, isn't that Roman Catholic, I'd say, well, it is. Roman Catholics do it, and certainly in America they seem to be the most dominant group doing it and the ones who do it the most. They probably also say the Lord's Prayer more than we do, and, you know, they do some other things, too, that we certainly wouldn't want to say, you know, that only belongs to them.
So what does the sign of the cross mean?
Well, it's a remembrance in the first place of who we are in Christ, that we have been redeemed by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and we have been marked by this cross and live by it. The sign of the cross was first made on us, most of us anyway, when we were baptized. It's part of the ceremonial action of baptism, and it was made physically, you know, scratched on the people, not with the thumbnail, but, you know, drawn on the people with a finger or with a thumb. And the pastor said something like, receive the sign of the cross, or be marked with the cross to mark you as one of the redeemed by Christ the Crucified, or something like that, to identify this person as belonging to God, being marked by that sign. And then whenever sort of now we make the sign of the cross, we're remembering who we are, that we've been marked by the cross, that we've been bought by Jesus Christ, purchased and won, that all of our life and all of our being and everything that there is defined by that event that happened outside of Jerusalem.
Now, you mentioned that this is simply a Christian practice. How far back does the practice of the sign of the cross go?
It goes clear back to the second century. So already in the 150 or somewhere in there, there's mention of this, in the Christian writings that they're doing this. In liturgical instructions and so forth, you know, there's things like make the sign of the cross and then say this. So it's very early. It probably goes clear back to the apostolic age. It certainly is the thing that St. Paul wants to talk about all the time, is the cross. We preach Christ crucified. It's funny, he doesn't say we preach Christ risen, though we do, of course, but the point of he is risen is he died. And the point of he died is he's not dead, but he died for us so that we would live. And he has risen so that we would rise. But the payment really is made for us, or has been made for us there, and that's the defining moment. I mean, it is kind of a strange thing. In some ways, you know, we've become too accustomed to the cross as a symbol or as a decoration, and I don't think we always think about necessarily what it is. We just sort of see it without seeing it. That's one reason I think that crucifixes are, you know, a crucifix with an actual body, or a, you know, not an actual body, but with the form of a body, a statue or something on the cross that looks like and reminds us that this was an instrument of execution and Jesus died. Crosses are a little bit like the ancient equivalent of the electric chair, or, you know, a hangman's noose. When Jesus says, pick up your cross and follow me, it's like he's saying, bring the rope they'll use to hang you. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing. This Christianity means death and separation from the world and your old life. And there's going to be some suffering that's going to come along with it. But through that suffering, God promises to bless you finally and in the ultimate way.
Well, you know, my youngest brother is in the military. And I remember when he was spending some time at Fort Leonard Wood in advanced training, officer training, which is not too far from where we live. So we went down there to see him. And being on that military base, it's really odd. There's an entirely different kind of a culture on a military base. It's a whole world set apart. And everyone there was undergoing intense training. And everywhere you went, you saw these officers snapping to attention when a superior officer walked by. There was a kind of a form of the way they dealt with one another physically in their gestures. Either snapped to attention. There was often a very brisk salute. I once asked him about this when we were down there, and he said, "Look, this is just the way that in the military you are taught to deal with one another and to recognize rank and to greet one another was with this salute, and it's a constant reminder." He says it's always there to reinforce that the essence of the military is a chain of command. Now, without straining the analogy, Pastor Peterson, what is it that the cross, obviously it's not a chain of command, really, what does the cross, this gesture, like a military salute, reinforce for the Christian who uses it?
Well, it certainly reminds us of who we are and of who God has revealed himself to be in his word, the one who is gracious and giving and forgiving. I think that it is, in fact, you know, very much an aid to prayer. You know, sometimes people will say, well, you know, all of these outward forms, they don't do anything, they don't add anything. And there's a sense in which, of course, that's completely true. I mean, God never demands in the scriptures that we fold our hands and bow our heads and close our eyes to pray, or that we join hands around the dinner table to pray, or that we use certain forms, or certainly make the sign of the cross, bow, kneel. I mean, none of those things are demanded. But the reality is that those things help to put us into the proper frame of mind, and it's harder to do it. It's harder to have the spirit in the right place if the body isn't. I mean, you can pray with your eyes wide open while you're watching The Simpsons, you know, but it's a little bit distracting, and it's a little bit easier if it's quiet and, you know, you're not looking around and your hands aren't fiddling around and scratching and so forth. And so, I mean, there is very much a sense in which psychologically or spiritually, these physical embodiments of what we believe, hope, and confess is very much a very real and helpful aid. Of course, any of these things, I mean, all things, except for grace itself, on this side of glory, are subject to abuse. And, I mean, if somebody starts to use the sign of the cross in a superstitious way, you know, for instance, the thing that really drives me crazy is this using the cross against vampires, you know, as though vampires are afraid of the cross. I could never understand as a child watching these horror movies why they wouldn't just cross their fingers, you know. I mean, do you remember this, Todd? Did you ever watch these vampire movies?
Oh, I sure did, yeah.
And I remember when we would play this, when my friends or my siblings and I would play, the, you know, vampires or whatever. I mean, that was always what we did because we never had wooden crosses or things to carry around in our pockets. So the kid that was the vampire, we warded off by just crossing our fingers, you know, and that would be the cross. Somehow that never seemed to be enough, you know. Well, of course it wasn't enough. The whole thing is ridiculous. As though, I mean, if the vampire is an embodiment of demons or the devil, I mean, the devil isn't bothered in the least bit by jewelry or by symbols. And, you know, that goes for holy water and garlic and all of these things. I mean, the devil's not going to be stopped because you have a crucifix around your neck or you make the sign of the cross over yourself. That has no power at all over the devil. And that is a perversion of what the cross or what the cross should be and what it should symbolize and remind us of. So, I mean, of course these things can be abusive or could be abused. But insofar as they are used by pious people, meaning to remind them of who they are, and in humility and so forth, they're certainly very useful and helpful. And in fact, I think that really, without any kind of physical ceremony or embodiment of what we confess and believe, in fact, it is much, much more difficult to pray or to keep these things in mind. And in fact, we are less likely to do it. Your mother did a good thing if she taught you to kneel by the side of your bed and list all of your relatives by name. Did your mother teach you that?
Yeah.
And did you try to say to her, but Mom, why can't I just say, God bless everyone?
Yeah, I always tried for the shortcut.
She wouldn't let you, would she?
No, we had to get both sides, grandparents.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, she wants you to actually remember them and think of them, and not just flippantly say, well, God bless everyone. And the fact is, if you have a routine and a discipline, you're much more likely to say your prayers. It's more difficult to skip them or to become cold in them. Uh, so So, I mean, all of these things do help.
We're talking with Pastor David Peterson about the sign of the cross. Pastor Peterson, one of the things I've found helpful about the sign of the cross is that it ties me, the individual Christian, back to the corporate, in particular the worship life of the whole church. There are points in the historic liturgy where the pastor and the people make the sign of the cross, and I want you to walk us through them very briefly. And why is the cross made at these points in historic worship?
Well, it has some connect. I mean, in each place there are different connections. I mean, I think that we ought to be careful a little bit, though. Just before, I mean, I think that's a very worthwhile thing to do. But I always want to tell people, you know, if you're learning about this for the first time, or you're just seeing people do this for the first time, and you're thinking, wow, this is so full and rich and meaningful, and I want to be part of this community that confesses outwardly and makes this sign of the cross. You know, don't worry about doing it wrong, and don't worry about doing it in the wrong place, because you just can't do it wrong. I mean, if you mean the right thing, you did it right. We don't want to get caught up in the details of this thing. And the same thing in the worship service. There are historic places where it's been done, but you know, if some place feels good to you to do it, I mean, go ahead. Or at the same way, I mean, if you're a little bit embarrassed or it feels awkward or strange to you, and you don't want to make it, don't do it. I mean, you know, you don't violate your conscience for the sake of this ceremony. But anyway, the first place that it's made is usually at what we call the invocation. So at the beginning of the service, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, which is exactly the formula from baptism. So it's very much a reminder of baptism. That in fact, I don't like the name invocation there. That's the Latin. That comes from the Latin to call. So an invocation is to call down or to call something out. And I would prefer that we don't call that formula the invocation, but we call it the innomine. It's to use the naming. And I'm a bit of a maverick here. Ceremonially, the most ancient way, the pastor usually faces the altar when he says in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and he makes the sign of the cross over himself. But there are some cases historically of pastors doing this, and I do it this way. I face the congregation, and I make the sign of the cross over them, so that we're not telling God now we're here and we're ready, and he's welcome to come into the building. You know, we're not invoking him, begging him to be with us, but rather the people are being blessed there. That's my idea, or my understanding, I should say.
Another place where the sign of the cross is made in the historic worship of the church is when the pastor pronounces the absolution or the forgiveness of sins after people have confessed their sins.
Right, right. And again, it's the idea that this is a blessing. That all of the blessings of life, and certainly of the faith, come from the cross and come from the foundational reality that God has called us by name in the waters of holy baptism and claimed us as his own. So the forgiveness of sins that is pronounced in the absolution, bestowed in the absolution, is based in baptism, is based in the crucifixion.
And then at the end, since you have, it seems pretty clear that this is a sign of blessing, that's why the cross again is made at the final benediction, the final blessing?
Very much, right. And of course, in the Lutheran liturgy, Luther's a maverick there with the, as a genius, I think, with the Aaronic benediction. So that's not in the Roman rite. The Roman rite just simply ends, the Mass has ended, go in peace. And I don't know what the Protestants do, but the Luther says we should use the Aaronic benediction from Numbers 6, I think. And, of course, that's where God says to Moses, tell Aaron to bless the people this way, and I will bless them. And it's the Lord bless thee and keep thee, the Lord make his face shine upon thee. So there's a very solid and certain scriptural blessing being pronounced there. And to combine it with the physical, you know, gesture of the cross being made over the people, the idea that this Trinitarian blessing and promise from Moses comes through the cross of Jesus Christ is a powerful ceremony.
I want to talk a bit about the sign of the cross and children, because this is something that children notice.
Yes.
They notice gestures, probably why, you know, often in Sunday school, gestures go along with children singing.
Yeah.
They notice these things. For them, when my son puts on his headphones and listens to his CDs, and he dances around. He's a great dancer. For him, he is acting out the words of the song. When they talk about crying, he acts like he's crying. Gesture means something to little children. Talk about children and the sign of the cross. My kids were doing it without any behest from their parents. They just saw the pastor doing it.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Yeah, they very much catch on to that. In my experience, the children are much more conscious and aware of ceremonies and of the rite, of the repetition of the words from week to week, more than the adults, and seem to me to be quite comforted by it. We normally have here in this church a gospel procession on Sundays. That is, that at the reading of the gospel, the book of the gospels is actually carried out to the middle of the church and read there instead of up in the front. And once in a while, we don't have enough people or something, and we won't do it. And you'd be amazed that sometimes the children get angry because we didn't do it right. And you see that too with bedtime stories and so forth. You know, if you don't make the right voice, or if you try to skip a page, or whatever, you know, they do notice and they are comforted. My children make the sign of the cross, and it's very important to them. They also fold their hands to pray, and they get very mad at the dinner table. They love to tell on one another. You know, if somebody takes a bite of food before we've prayed, or if somebody gets caught, you know, with his eyes open or not folding his hands, they like to tell on one another. So they do use those as, you know, clues as to what's happening and what's appropriate and what's proper. I think it does place them in the right frame of mind.
Pastor David Peterson, thank you very much for joining us on Issues Etc. again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Pastor David Peterson is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled The Sign of the Cross. Now, if you're looking for a great Christmas gift for a teenager or a college-age student, I was thinking just today, my daughter turned 12 yesterday. And I thought to myself, you know, she doesn't have a subscription to Higher Things. She should. It's written right at her level, actually, her parents' level, too. You need to get your kid, your grandkid, some kid you know, a subscription to Higher Things magazine. You can subscribe online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the Links with Regular Guests link, and you'll find a direct link to Todd Peppercorn and Higher Things, or you can write Higher Things magazine, P.O. Box 580111, Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, 53158. The address again, P.O. Box 580111, Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, 53158. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with two guests, Connie Mackey, Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., and Senator Jim Talent of Missouri. Both of them will bring to us the subject, this battle in the U.S. Senate that's taking place, a talkathon. What is it, an anti-filibuster? A 30-hour marathon talk session on the floor of the Senate to protest, as far as I can tell, the intransigence of the Democrats over the president's judicial nominees. That's right after this.
Preaching Christ and Him Crucified. You're listening to Issues Etc.
17th century theologian Johann Gerhardt wrote of Christ's intercession for us in prayer. What will the Heavenly Father deny His beloved Son? What will our gracious Savior not obtain by the power and merit of His satisfaction accomplished for us? The shrine of heaven stands open to Him. Christ delivers our prayers to the secret counsel of God. Will the Father not hear Him? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is called Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. You can order Meditations on Divine Mercy by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Bible college students in India who can get a rude awakening. Preaching Christ's good news can lead to controversy. Bible college students with the India Evangelical Mission can't predict what type of reaction they'll get after sharing Christ in India's villages. Training with IEM equips the students to handle the unexpected and to pray over their efforts. In India's different states, some Christians may experience serious persecution, while others are warmly welcomed into the homes of Hindu families. India Evangelical Mission has trained more than 400 graduates who are now in ministry throughout the country. Pray for Christ to be proclaimed in India and for Christians to effectively share with Hindus, Muslims, and spirit worshipers. Get information on India by calling 1-800-268-0461. Ask for the free brochure, To India with Love. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I fondly remember evening meals when I was growing up near Chicago. Every meal started with grace, and then we dug into whatever Mom had prepared. We also dug into conversation. Most of the table talk was mundane, quickly forgotten. But you know, that's when God did, and still does, some of His best for a family. When you are gathered around a meal, talking about everyday things, there's always an opportunity to share a good word with one another from God. Today, many families seldom eat together because of the press of busy schedules. We've justified that with a false distinction between quantity and quality time. The fact is, you need both. Recommitting to the old habit of family meals gives quantity time from which quality moments spring. You'll find it one of the most effective tools for good parenting and better marriages. Awaiting you is more than the grace of the mealtime prayers. The greatest grace awaiting you in family meals is that in the midst of everyday talk, you can share with one another God's words of help and hope. Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest, and let thy gifts to us be blessed. Amen.
Hey. You've heard the saying, it's a jungle out there. That's true. But if you're like most of today's families, it's a jungle right here, right now. Find direction with Dr. James Dobson and focus on the family. Straight answers and solid advice for dealing with life in the jungle.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Picking up on the conversation we just finished with Pastor Peterson on the sign of the cross, from our Issues, Etc. book of the month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy. This is a prayer recorded by its author, Johann Gerhardt. O holy God, just judge, I see your Son hanging on the cross, streams of blood flowing freely. I look at him and behold, I become weak with terror. Those cruel nails are my sins, with which I have pierced his hands and feet. Those terrible thorns are my sins, with which I have crowned his holy head. Those sharply pointed lashes are my sins, with which I have scourged his faultless body. O most righteous God, yet most kind Father, behold how unworthily your Son suffered for me. Forget how unworthily I, your wretched servant, have acted. Look into Christ's deep wounds and plunge my sins into the deepest depths of the sea of your mercy. That is an appropriate quote from our Issues, Etc. book of the month, Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next 90 minutes or weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can also visit Concordia Publishing House at their two locations. They have bookstores both at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis and here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc. Joining us here for this second part of the first hour of Issues, Etc., to talk about the battle in the U.S. Senate over President George W. Bush's judicial nominees, Connie Mackey, Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Connie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Connie. What's going on in the Senate floor?
Well, you've got 30 hours of debate, I should say, of battle between the Democrats and the Republicans over the obstruction of President Bush's nominees to the circuit and appellate courts.
And what brought this about, this debate?
Well, what brought it about is the fact that in, almost 200 years, we've never had one party completely obstruct, not even allow a vote up or down on some of the most important judges, judge appointments, judicial appointments, I should say, that the president puts forward.
This has been called in the press a stealth filibuster, not the protest, but what led to it, the blockage of cloture votes for these judicial nominees, discussion for these judicial nominees, a stealth filibuster. What should a real filibuster look like?
Well, a real filibuster, I think a lot of the Republicans would maintain, is almost mythical in that it's impossible to keep, that group, that any group, let alone that group of lawmakers, in a room for that long a period of time. But basically what has happened now is that it requires that the party calling the quorum is are the Republicans. Therefore, they have to have all of the Republicans, all 51 Republicans, on the floor or within the room off the floor, present for all of the time that the filibuster goes on. And they are doing that. They have whipped all 51 Republicans in place. Now, the Democrats do not have to have all their members there. So, frankly, it's a piece of cake for them. They can have they can have some of their people float in and out, but all of the Republicans have to be present. Therefore, this 30 hours is probably the most that they feel they can humanly do. They will then close after 30 hours and go to cloture to a vote on three women judges that have been up for some time: Priscilla Owens from Texas, Judge Brown, and Carolyn Kuhl. Judge Carolyn Kuhl. Those two are both from California. They'll get a try to get a cloture vote on them. But what's been happening is the Democrats are refusing to, once they even vote them out of committee, they're refusing to vote, give them a vote up or down at all. And that is the first time in history that's ever happened.
What do the Democrats find objectionable about these nominees? And we should also mention Miguel Estrada, who was filibustered stealthily in the Senate and eventually just grew tired after 2 years and withdrew his name.
Right. Well, I think what's happened here is this. We've come to a point in our history where those people who have defended abortion all these years see a climate change, and they're very afraid that if they got strict constitutionalist judges, that those judges might see their way to overturning Roe v. Wade, and that scares the life out of their base. And so they are pledged, and they're hooked to the hip to NARAL now and those organizations to protect the right of abortion, and that's what it's about. Quite frankly, they are scared to death that that Roe v. Wade was a terrible ruling in the Supreme Court, and that is said by those who are pro-abortion as well. So they're very afraid that bad ruling might be corrected, and they're doing everything that they can to prevent that from happening, including not even allowing a vote. They can vote against these people, but they won't even let it come to a vote.
When we were dealing with the case of Miguel Estrada, we were being told that the reason Estrada's nomination was being blocked and no vote being allowed was because he refused to answer a series of questions that his opponents thought were extremely necessary. What was your take on that?
Well, it was bogus. If you were here in Washington and we saw the reams, and I mean reams, of questions that he's answered. But what they do, it's a tactic. And no matter what he says and no matter what questions he answers, they're going to have more and more and more. And it doesn't matter how many he answers. They're going to have more, and they're going to reframe the same questions that he answered. It's a tactic. It was a tactic to keep him out because the Democrats also don't want the Republicans. We've already been the Republicans have already been the first party to put a woman on the Supreme Court. They don't want the Republican Party to be the first ones to put a Hispanic judge on the Supreme Court. Even though it's the appellate court that we were talking about, they're easily moved up from the appellate into a Supreme Court situation should there be a resignation.
Now, we'll continue our conversation here with Connie Mackey in just a moment. She'll rejoin us in just a second. Right now, we have Senator Jim Talent of Missouri on the line. He's one of the senators who is partaking in this 30-hour protest up on Capitol Hill. Senator Talent, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. And what Connie's saying is exactly right. I'm glad she's there to say it.
Senator, are you tired?
Yeah, I'm getting a little tired now. I was up most of the night and starting to wear me. I'm going to go down on the floor in about 20 minutes, but I'm more tired of this abuse than I am just tired. It's an usurpation of constitutional power. Very clearly that it hurts the courts. And it hurts these nominees who have worked so hard, in many cases overcome such handicaps. We were just talking about Miguel Estrada, such difficulties, and who deserve to be confirmed and deserve not to have their reputation slandered by people who have an extreme political agenda. So I'm a lot more tired of that than I am tired now.
So what are the Senate Republicans hoping to accomplish here?
Well, there's several. This is designed to operate on several levels. One of them is to raise the visibility of this issue with that group of people who can do something about it, which is the voters. And, you know, the voters in Mississippi elected Haley Barbour governor by a very large margin, and many of us think that was in part because the Democrats had just filibustered Pickering and killed that nomination, and the people in Mississippi didn't like it. So part of this is to just basically, as part of an appeal to the voters, part of it is to keep pressure on them. You see, I think as bad as it has been, and they have filibustered or threatened to filibuster a quarter of the president's Court of Appeals nominees. I don't think it has been as bad as it would have been had we not kept the spotlight on it. So I'm thinking that the marginal nominees, the ones they're thinking about doing, they may not do now because they're losing this debate, I think, and it's operating on that level. And then the third thing is just to vent our frustration with our colleagues in the Senate. This is an abuse of the traditions of the Senate. It's wrong. And it's also, I said this last night on the floor, it's wrong to say to the tens and tens of millions of people in this country who want to protect the unborn that just because you disagree with them, they're so extreme that they're not fit even to have a vote on whether they should be able to serve under the in the judicial branch under the Constitution of the United States. I mean, that's not just disagreeing with somebody. That's giving them the back of your hand. And we wanted to say those things, and that's why we're doing this.
Senator Talent, I'm wondering whether or not, and this is something that I've heard discussed in the last several days ever since the protest talkathon, that's what they're calling it, began, and that is, if the Democrats vote through any of these nominees, especially the erstwhile Estrada or Judge Brown, both of whom are considered to be kind of Supreme Court material in the future, mm-hmm. if they approve them now, they will have a hard time voting against them if they become a nominee for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's part of what's working here. They want to hunt down, if you will, and get rid of now anybody who might be on the Supreme Court. They're playing a very high stakes game here. But what they have to recognize is what they want should be confined by the parameters of the Constitution of the United States as it's always been interpreted by both parties. I mean, they don't have the right just to go, they may have the raw power under the Senate rules, but they don't have the right to do this. And they're forcing basically, a confrontation over the constitutionality of the Senate rules, which I welcome. I don't think this rule is constitutional, and I welcome the fact that they're forcing us to confront that issue.
Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle of South Dakota said as the protest began, "We begin tonight what I view to be a colossal waste of time." He went on later to say, The Republicans are consumed by these four jobs, that is, for the judges, and ignore 3 million jobs that we've lost over the course of the last 3 years under this administration's economic policies. Your reaction?
Well, it's typical. Instead of confronting these gigantic issues that we're raising, they basically use slogans. We can get off this in 10 minutes. All they have to do is agree to a time limit for a vote on these nominees. They, you know, they're the ones who are filibustering. One thing I've said to the press over and over again, you know, you can filibuster or not filibuster. You can't filibuster and then claim the other side's being obstructionist. All Senator Daschle has to do is agree on behalf of the Democrats for some time limit so that we know we're going to go to vote on these four nominees, and this debate will end 10 minutes after that.
Senator Evan Bayh also simply said, this is all about power. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not all about power, but it's there's a big part of it that's about power. Senator Schumer, Chuck Schumer from New York, who I work with on a number of issues and like personally, said the other night when I was presiding that one of the big problems here is that even though he's the ranking Democrat on the court subcommittee, the Judiciary Committee, the White House doesn't come to him before making these nominations, that they just come to him and consult with him, we wouldn't have these problems. Yeah, it's a question of power. I mean, what they want is basically a co-presidency on the issue of appointing judges. And, you know, as I said, I personally like Chuck Schumer, but I don't like his politics. And nobody in Missouri had a chance to vote for or against him for president. We got one president, and he's the one who has the power to make these nominations. This is an attempt to take power away from him and aggregate it in the hands of a minority of the Senate.
At the end of this 30 hours, there will be a call for a cloture vote on the nominees, the judicial nominees. Will there be that vote?
Yeah, we'll have a vote on cloture. I wish I could tell you and your listeners that I thought the result was going to change, but I don't. I think we will have a solid majority for a vote, and I think we would have a solid majority to confirm, but we will probably not have the 60 votes necessary under the Senate rules. We will, however, have highlighted the issue. I think we probably will get more nominees through than we otherwise would because of this. And I think we will then be positioned to take whatever step next year we feel appropriate to take, up to and including challenging the constitutionality of this rule on the Senate floor.
Senator, if the tables were turned and we had a Democratic president with his nominees there and a slight majority of Democrats in the House, would the Republicans contemplate doing the same thing that the Democrats have been doing with those nominees?
I never have. And as a matter of fact, there have been a couple of times when groups of senators, in some cases Republicans, have tried a filibuster and the Republican leadership has supported motions to end the debate on the grounds that a filibuster was not appropriate. Now, they're putting us in a difficult position as a practical matter because, I mean, if we're going to be in a situation where when our president, when our party controls the White House, they filibuster such a high percentage of the Court of Appeals nominees, and then they turn around and try and insist on the regular order when their party controls the White House. And it puts you in a very, very difficult position that I would much prefer not to be in. And so I can't say for certain that there won't be a reaction on our side of the aisle, but we've never done that in the past, and I don't think we would again.
Finally, Senator, can this process be changed? If so, how?
Well, it could be changed either by a bipartisan agreement, which could encompass judicial nominations in general, and I would welcome that. A bipartisan agreement that nominees get a hearing, they get a vote, et cetera, and that would apply to presidents of both parties. The other way to change it is to raise a point of order on the Senate floor that the filibuster rule, as applied to executive nominations as opposed to laws, and there's a difference between the executive calendar and the legislative calendar, okay, as applied to executive nominations, that filibuster rule violates the Constitution, and that therefore all you need is a simple majority to end debate on nominations. You would have to, if you raise that point of order, you would need a majority of the Senate to support it. And right now, see, I don't think we have a majority because I think there's a lot of our people who are reluctant to limit the filibuster in any context. And so, but that is a potential option down the road.
Senator Jim Talent, thank you very much for being our guest, giving us your time, and I hope you get some sleep soon.
Thanks, Don. I'm going to be fine. Appreciate it.
Senator Jim Talent of Missouri, he joined us live from Washington, D.C. Connie Mackey is back on the line, Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council, also based in Washington, D.C., to round off this half hour of Issues, Etc. Connie, I'd like your reaction to the question that I posed to the senator there, and that being that if the Democrats indeed approve any of these nominees that are controversial for a federal court position, they would eventually have a very hard time not voting for them if they were Supreme Court nominees from George W. Bush.
That's exactly right. Frankly, I want to tell you, I'm looking for a little sympathy for FRC. We were there all night long with the senators doing press conferences and everything we could to support them. But on a more serious note, that's also part of this run around the Constitution by the Democrats, and it makes me fearful for our government when things can be so twisted and misconstrued. Look, you know, I personally didn't vote for Clinton and didn't like the years he was in, but I know that we complied with the laws and respected the Constitution, and who is elected is the person that we have to we have to put up with them if we don't like them. And they're determined to not follow the Constitution, to thwart it, and to have their way as a minority.
There are calls in the conservative media as we speak for the Senate to not stop at 30 hours, but to push this until eventually the Democrats say, enough, you can have your cloture vote, and we'll just let it happen.
The reason that won't happen is what I said before. 51 Republicans have to be ever present. I mean, and not all of those Republicans are conservative enough to want to have this kind of heart. I don't think it can hold. It wouldn't hold, and I'm sure you won't see that happen. They only have a short amount of time to put together some kind of an omnibus bill or some kind of continuing resolution so that they can get home to their home base and be the representatives to their communities that they're supposed to be. So I'll be honest with you, I don't see that happening.
How does this stealth filibuster and the protest of it by the Senate Republicans, how does it figure into the fact that one-third of the Senate does stand for re-election in, well, just about a year?
Mm-hmm. I think, as the senator says, by taking their case to the public, it will affect. I definitely think it will affect. I mean, what they're trying to do is to show the American public in sort of a civics 101 how the Constitution is being thwarted, who's doing it, and making the case as to why they're doing it and how it's unethical. Frankly bringing the case to the public. So I do think it will affect the elections. I think the senator was right. Haley Barbour's election was certainly, I think, reflective of that, given what they've done to Mr. Pickering, who has been a stalwart in the civil rights movement there. And that is not just said by me. I attended a press conference where half the audience were the black people from that state who counted on him to push the inequities that were existent there, I mean, to stop them and to push fair civil laws forward, which he's done. And that was just pitiful to see a man pilloried who had done so much for those who needed the help so much.
I'd like your reaction to this comment from Senator Dick Durbin from my home state. He says that instead of looking for compromises to resolve the issues that American people really are concerned about, the Republicans are instead spending 30 hours, he says, grinding red meat for their right wing. Your response?
I can almost do nothing but laugh. I mean, it's all so demagogic and so phony. They're playing a ruthless game. The Republicans have called their number on it. We're only hoping that the American public catches on and makes them pay a price for it.
Are we looking at in this protest? Are we looking at what a filibuster ought to really look like? If a filibuster were really conducted, cots on the Senate floor, people having to stay the time, having to keep the floor, things like that, instead of this simple refusal to bring a cloture vote?
You're asking me what about that? I'm sorry. Well, what was your question?
I'm asking, people are watching this on television. They're seeing haggard senators.
Right.
And they're saying, you know, that's what a filibuster is. That's what it ought to look like. Is that part of what the Republicans are trying to do? Say, if we're going to really have a filibuster on these nominees, then this is what should be taking place, these all-nighters.
Well, I get, yes. I think that is, it is a demonstration of what the public, the public has been demanding, the senators to do something about this. And, yes, if I've got your question correct and you're asking me, you know, is this some part of showmanship? And in that sense, it is to show the American public what has to happen when, again, as I can only continue to say is that the Constitution is being thwarted, the rules are being thwarted, and part of what they want also is to push through the Frist-Miller filibuster reform proposal, which will hopefully, if they can get that through, of course they have to have ultimately 60 votes to get that through as well. But they're looking for a rule change here so that this tactic cannot be used again.
Finally, with less than a minute before we have to go, I asked for your reaction there to Senator Durbin's comments about the protest. Should our listeners in Illinois call Senator Durbin's office? And if so, what should they say on the occasion of this protest?
I think they should ask him for fairness and for an adherence to the laws and to the Constitution. That's what they should expect of a Republican or a Democrat, of anyone who is elected to public office, should play by the rules. And if Durbin doesn't like President Bush, or if they're worried about losing seats in the next election, they should put that behind them and give these human beings that have achieved so much in their lives, have given their lives to their country, and are asking for an opportunity to be on, or accepting the nomination of the president, I should say. I don't think they look for this. I can't imagine who would. But are standing there willing to accept the nomination and putting their whole lives, their families' lives, everybody on the line. They should be treated fairly, and Dick Durbin and everyone else should stop playing these games and treat these people like the human beings they are.
Connie Mackey, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc. Connie Mackey is Director of Government Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Visit them on the web at frc.org. frc.org, or by phone, area code 202-393-2100, 202, area code 393-2100. In the next hour of the program, hour two of Issues Etc., Pastor Rod Zwanitzer joins us. We're going to talk about where the church growth movement is going. What's its future? He's read up on it. He'll bring it to us after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.